My name is Peter Holmer. The title of this session is The Call of the Inner Life. Good evening and welcome. I guess the goal of tonight and the next few times we meet together, if you can, is I would like you to meet a very good friend of mine, and that is this person right here, Eddie Hillison. Someone that I enjoy knowing. And she was given to me as a gift by a friend. We were in Chicago walking down the street, and my friend was telling me about this great book, and he promptly walked into a bookstore and bought it for me and said, "Now meet this person." And for that, I'm grateful. It's the story of Eddie Hillison. And as I read the story of this person, I also became instructed, if you will, about my own life, and particularly about spiritual life. I'll begin a little bit with a biography, if you will, to kind of set the stage. As Walt mentioned at dinner, the time is that very black period in our world's history, the 20th century, of the Nazi domination of the world and the extermination systematically of Jews and millions of others. Eddie Hillison was a Dutch Jew. In 1940, Holland fell to the Germans. And yet Holland has always been kind of a place of religious freedom. And the first ever anti-pogrom riots were held in February of 41, and to which the Germans clamped down rather heavily on the Jewish population with their reign of terror. Eddie Hillison was from a rural city in eastern Holland. Her father was a headmaster of a high school, a very educated household. She had a brother who was very bright and became a doctor, and another brother, Misha, who was a concert pianist and some felt one of the leading contenders for best in Europe. And she began her studies in a law degree in Amsterdam, followed by a specialty in Slavic languages, particularly in Russian. And she had just embarked upon a study of psychology. The diaries begin in March of 1941. And coincidentally, this is the very time she meets one of the key characters of the diary, a Dr. Speer, who was a serologist, a palm reader. Now that sounds rather hokey and gypsy-like, but evidently this person had studied with Carl Jung, who encouraged him to go into this palm reading slash therapy. And so it wasn't just palm reading, but he was into therapy. And Eddie became first one of his clients, and later his personal secretary and lover during this time. So this person, S. Speer, is a big part of her diaries. She lived right in the main square in Amsterdam between the Rijksmuseum and the Concert Hall, if you've ever been there. It's a beautiful center of life, and she lived in a house where she rented a room with five other individuals. And yet this beer fellow had quite a following, and they would gather for music, conversation, and it was quite an intellectual circle. And so she moves between these two households. But the entry into her therapy kind of unlocked in her the will to do something that she had always thought about doing, which was writing. And so to the document, if you will. On your Xeroxes here, you'll see page 8 and 9 are the first one. And you get a look at Eddie. We're on page 8 under Wednesday night at the bottom. Second to the last line, she writes, "Call it by its proper name, ambition. What I put down on paper must be perfect right away. I don't like putting in the daily grind, and I'm not sure of my own talent. It doesn't really feel like an organic part of me. In near ecstatic moments, I think myself capable of God knows what, only to sink back again into the deepest pit of uncertainty. That happens because I fail to work each day at what I believe is my real talent, writing. Theoretically, I've known that for a long time. A few years ago, I scribbled on a scrap of paper, "Grace, during its rare appearances, must be welcomed with polished skill." But that was something that leapt out of my brain and still hasn't been translated into flesh and blood. Has a new phase of my life really begun? The question mark is wrong. A new phase shall begin. Battle has been joined. Battle isn't right either, since at this moment I feel so good and harmonious, so utterly whole, or rather my awareness is growing apace, and everything that was locked in my head until now in the shape of precisely worked out formulae is about to flow into my heart. We see Eddie at a real transition point in her life. She's gonna be a writer, and now she's thought she was talented, and now she's gonna do it. And what was theoretically to her is going to have to flow from her head into her heart and into flesh and blood, and that's very key. But what we're gonna find is it's not just a head trip that Eddie's on here. Very soon we're gonna discover her purpose, which is in the last paragraph here. Everything, I'm reading at the bottom of the main paragraph, everything will have to become more straightforward. Until the end, I shall perhaps finish up as an adult, capable of helping other souls who are in trouble, and of creating some sort of clarity through my work for others, for that's what it's really all about. So very early on in her diaries, she finds her purpose. She's going to write, and the purpose is not just for herself, but that others might be helped by what she's about. And she's expressing that she is not disciplined, she hasn't done her daily work. But very early on, she sets the tone for her work. I think it'd behoove us to take a little look at what I would call a developing writer and a developing worker. And I would just quickly read a few excerpts from her diary about some of the things she's up against and wants to do. Any of us that want to start a new venture that we feel is true to our heart aren't going to start as experts, whether it's a spiritual life or a new job or a new career. She writes, "It all comes out so clumsily, but then you don't put things down on paper to produce masterpieces, but to gain some clarity." Anybody here a journalist, a journaler? Why do you do it?
Now, did you mean journalist?
Journaler, who has a journal or a diary.
Keep going.
Anybody write a diary or a journal? Why do you do it?
clarify my thoughts to, and then I go back and read, see where I've been from, and because it feels good most of the time, not always. I really couldn't tell you. It's just something that.
How long you been doing?
About 10 years.
How did you feel when you began?
Well, I had to get rid of an awful lot of ideas I had to begin with, because I had all sorts of set ideas of how this should be done, shouldn't be done. I had to get rid of a lot of that. So it was sort of an unlearning process almost.
Okay. Did you feel someone was looking over your shoulder when you...
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And now you continue to do this.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For clarity, though,
uh-huh.
about your life.
Uh-huh.
All right. Would you call that a spiritual exercise?
For me, it is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. she's writing to gain clarity. "I am still ashamed of myself," she goes on, "afraid to let myself go, to let things pour out of me. I am dreadfully inhibited, and that is because I have not yet learned to accept myself as I am." I think there's a real key here to any enterprise, especially a spiritual one. We got to start where we start, not where we think we ought to be. She continues, "I must abandon all the laziness and particular of my inhibitions and insecurity. If I'm ever to find myself, and through others, through my finding myself, find others." That's always her goal. This is not just navel gazing. It's her contention that if she understands herself, she's going to be able to relate to others. Very early on, she makes that premise. Now, the inner life, who traditionally has an inner life in Christianity? What disciplines? What do you think of? Contemplation, inner life.
Monks and nuns.
Mystics, Trappists, that kind of person. And really, in the Lutheran tradition, you don't have a lot of that. And we're the doers, right?
Get an inner life.
Yeah, an inner life, you know. Here's this Jew writes early on, "Sometimes I long for a convent cell." Very natural, right? "With the sublime wisdom of centuries set out on bookshelves all along the wall and a view across the cornfields." There must be cornfields, and they must wave in the breeze. "And there I would immerse myself in the wisdom of the ages and in myself. Then I might perhaps find peace and clarity. But that would be no great feat. It is right here, in this very place, in the here and now, that I must find them." So she's making a decision that if she's going to have an inner life, it's got to be now. Not in the convent, not with all the books on the wall. So I think that's kind of like you and me. And most of us aren't ready to go off to the monastery or the nunnery. And so what she's going to be about, she says she has to do now. So she's kind of outlining her journey here until we get to a very, what I would call the reason. Why does she need to go to some place inside? Why does she need to think and journal? She gives us a clue on page 41. "I am sometimes so distracted by all the appalling happenings around me that it's far from easy to find the way back to myself. And yet that's what I must do. I mustn't let myself be ground down by the misery outside." And I think anybody that's in a helping profession knows how easy it is to get ground down by the misery outside. And what's going on outside her life? Literally, people being rounded up and taken away and murdered and killed. And she doesn't want to become so distracted that she's going to lose herself. So she's feeling the necessary pull inward. And she makes a very... As she speaks, there's planes falling out of the sky and bombings and all this. As she writes, she says this: "A poem by Rilke is as real and as important as a young man falling out of an airplane on fire." What do you think she means by that? A poem is important as the airplanes and bombs and the horror around her. Is there time for poetry in the middle of a war? She says, absolutely yes. Why? Anybody got an idea?
Save her mind and her spirit. Keep her from going crazy.
Yeah. That she has to feed her soul if she's going to respond to, the Holocaust around her. How many of us get so busy we don't have time to read poetry, say our prayers, go to a quiet place because we got to do the next right thing, because everything's so crazy this week. When are we going to get around to refueling next week?
I'd say the key word there for me is real. Isn't that the word?
Yes.
As real.
It's as real.
It's the question of what is reality, and is reality only the largest and most dramatic misery that's in front of us? Or does that have to be... Does the young man falling a fire from the plane have to be juxtaposed by another perspective and another reality juxtaposed? Somehow reality is in the bumping of the poem and the burning man.
What is real?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes?
In the middle of World War I, I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. That was a soldier fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe to keep his sanity. He wrote the poem.
I was also thinking about that Aristotelian notion of truth. What is truth? Not only what is real, and then
but what is true? And if somebody falling out of an airplane, a pirate airplane, that's truth on one level. But poetry, metaphors, words, description, language, that's truth too. And both of them are real, but they're both then truth. So I think you can make the leap to the next thing.
Okay, on your Xerox, 46 and 47, if you got one handy. Should be on the back of that page, is that right? She's fine-tuning more as she looks at poetry and bombs and airplanes and taking a look at her history. Page 46, Friday morning, 9 o'clock. Right now I feel like I'm someone recovering from a serious illness. Light in the head and a bit shaky on the legs. Really was a bit much yesterday. The fact is I don't lead a simple enough inner life. I indulge in excesses. Bacchanelli of the spirit. It's a good phrase. Perhaps I identify too much with everything I read and study. Someone like Dostoevsky still shatters me. I really must become a bit simpler. Let myself live a bit more. Not always insist on the results straight away. Anybody like that in this room? Identifying with everything? We got to remember, she's 27 years old now. Kind of rewind to your student days a little bit here. She's a post, and where everything is just everything, and everything is so important. And in her case, I mean, it's life and death around here. But she's saying, I identify too much with everything. What's the remedy? I know what the remedy is, though. Just to crouch huddled up on the ground in a corner and listen to what is going on inside me. Thinking gets you nowhere. It may be a fine and noble aid in academic studies, but you can't think your way out of emotional difficulties. That takes something altogether different. You have to make yourself passive then and just listen. Reestablish contact with a slice of eternity. What's the difference between listening in a ball on the floor and thinking? What is she saying?
The difference between feeling and intellectualizing. I mean, feeling isn't an intellectual process. You can intellectualize it, but you can't. They're not the same.
Why does she say she...
The one's experiencing it itself, and the other is sort of an objective process.
What does it mean to listen to yourself?
I think part of it is letting things fall into their own categories independent of what your ideas were before. It's allowing things to reorganize themselves in your mind without your working at it. Just kind of experiencing it in a different way. It's a way of allowing the situation to reframe it in your own imagination.
What makes that possible? What makes it possible? To listen to listen rather than think. Tough concept. I agree with you.
I'm thinking that there might be thinking here, as you used here, might have some category of judgment in a sense of a non-gracious receiving, a second guessing of oneself.
What do I have to do with this is kind of a thinking thing. Where does it fit in? That's a judgment thing. Is that what you're saying? Rather than listening?
Yeah.
Or rather than letting what's there be, to say it's not good enough, it's the wrong thing, this thing shouldn't be there, how do I change it into it being something else? In other words, to receive one's feelings in an atmosphere of grace rather than an atmosphere of judgment.
To listen is to receive one's feelings. Is that a good definition? I really think it is. And we have to cut away judgment. Where does this lead? Is it right or wrong? But really feel. And she's saying to do that, she has got to kind of shut out the world for a while and get quiet and listen. And just kind of see where she's at. Take stock of herself. That's what she says the solution of overindulgence of the spirit. She calls this reestablishing contact with a slice of eternity. oddly enough. Jumping down a little farther, right in the middle of the next paragraph, but why do I have to achieve things? See that phrase? Why do I have to achieve things? All I need to do is to be, to live, and to try being a little bit human. One can't control everything with the brain. Must allow one's emotions and intuitions free play as well. She's explaining this. What's the difference between just being and doing? I have to just be and stop doing.
Well, doing has an end result normally, you know, or with the intent of an end result. And sometimes it's a justification. But being is you're not justifying, there's no, it's just an acknowledgement that you are.
That you are. And an acceptance of what's happening. That you don't have to do anything with it. Like you said, that it doesn't have to go anywhere, that it isn't right or wrong, that you just are. I have to learn to be, she says, not to achieve, but to be. And she goes on to knowledge and power, but she concludes, a little peace, a lot of kindness, and a little wisdom. Whenever I have these inside me, I feel I'm doing well. So she's kind of going on to think, I need to be more, I need to listen more, and I would say get centered more. Now, I'm going to get on to what a real big change in her life here in a minute, but I'd like to stop on page 55 in the book, if you have a book here. At the same time, she's living a real life, just like you and I. She says, sometimes it takes so much effort to get through the daily round. Getting up, washing, exercises, putting on stockings without holes, laying the table, in short, getting through the basics. That little is left over for other things. Yet when, like any other decent citizen, I get up on time, I feel proudly that I've achieved something marvelous. That's what I need desperately. Discipline from without, as long as my inner discipline is still so imperfect. If I stay in bed an extra hour in the morning, it doesn't mean I need more sleep, but simply that I'm unable to cope. If someone would desire a spiritual life, beginning a journal, setting a time to meditate and prayer, she's suggesting that what's going to have to start is some discipline on the outside. Sven said the other night, that he's found his Sabbath time must be planned for. If you're going to become a journaler, the next question is, what time of the day? When do you do yours?
Actually, mine varies. It really does vary. And I don't journal every single day. But usually morning.
Usually morning.
Early morning.
You know, what time are we going to do this? And if I don't have a discipline of night, time to get around to it because I haven't done the other things in my life, well, then a shame on me. And she's saying that until my inner life gets together, I got to work on my outer life. So there have been times when I've been more spiritual than others, but to me, if I'm interested in getting a depth to my life, it seems to suggest here that I can create the space by ordering my life and getting somewhat disciplined. Just a little footnote. Moving on now to what I think is also key to an inner life. If you have a book, page 55 and 56, actually. It's a slow and painful process, this striving after true inner freedom. She makes the conclusion, growing more and more certain that there is no help or assurance or refuge in others, that the others are just as uncertain and weak and helpless as you are. You're always thrown back on your own resources. There is nothing else, the rest is make-believe. But that fact has to be recognized over and over again, especially since you are a woman. For women always longs to lose herself in another, but that too is a fiction, albeit a beautiful one. There's no matching of lives, at least not for me. Perhaps for a few moments, but do these moments justify a lifetime together? Can those few moments cement a shared existence? All they can do is give you a little strength and perhaps a little happiness. God knows being alone is hard, for the world is inhospitable. In the past, I used to dream of giving it to one person, but it was not to be. And when you reach that such painful truth at the age of 27, you sometimes feel quite desperate and lonely and anxious, although independent and proud at the same time. I have confidence in myself and shall manage by myself. The only measure you have is yourself. And the only responsibility you can shoulder in life is responsibility for yourself. But you must do it with all your strength. Not that she's disconnecting herself from others, but if she's going to find strength, security, and meaning, she's not going to get it from you, you, or you. She's not going to find it in becoming married. She's not going to find it, at least for herself, there. She says, I only have one responsibility, and that's kind of the Socratic invitation to know herself. And that's a responsibility for everyone. And yet, you come in then in any kind of an inner life thing, it can get awful lonely in there. And I want to read a little bit from Kierkegaard here, because he was good on loneliness. In Sickness Unto Death here, talking about the Christian sinner. On the other hand, he often feels the need of solitude, which for him is a vital necessity, sometimes like breathing, at other times like sleeping. The fact is that he feels this vital necessity more than other men is also a sign that he has a deeper nature. Generally, the need of solitude is a sign that there is a spirit in a man after all, and it is a measure for what that spirit there is. The purely twaddling inhuman and too human men are such degree without feeling for the need for solitude that, like a certain species of social birds, the so-called lovebirds, they promptly die if for an instant they have to be alone. As the little child must be put to sleep by a lullaby, so these men need the tranquilizing hum of society before they are able to eat, drink, sleep, pray, fall in love, etc. But in ancient times, as well as the Middle Ages, people were more aware of the need of solitude and had respect for what it signifies. In the constant sociability of our age, people shudder at solitude to such a degree that they know no other use to put it to but as a punishment for criminals. That's pretty condemning. But I think he's got his finger on the pulse there. We've got to know each other and find each other and be with each other, and we don't know what to do without our television on or something input or whatever. But after all, it is a fact that in our age it is a crime to have spirit. So it's natural that such people, the lovers of solitude, are included in the same class with criminals. I think that's where Eddie's at right now. He's about ready to embrace solitude. And yet, that's mea culpa. You know, gee, the idea of a busy pastor being alone. Are you doing your work then? Are you achieving anything? Have you produced anything? I mean, those are the demons that get me. But I have a responsibility for that. Turning to your Xeroxes here, page 64-5, is that there, I hope? I've kind of entitled in my own mind this as Eddie Hillison's conversion experience. Anybody want to read? A woman's voice would be nice.
I'll read.
Can you take it from first page in the middle down, God Take Me By Your Hand? Can you read that? Up to maybe the second line on 65.
Okay. God, take me by your hand. I shall follow you dutifully and not resist too much. I shall evade none of the tempest life has in store for me. I shall try to face it all as best I can. But now and then grant me a short respite. I shall never again assume in my innocence that any peace will be eternal. I shall accept all the inevitable tumult and struggle. I delight in warmth and security, but I shall not rebel if I have to suffer cold, should you so decree. I shall follow wherever your hand leads me and shall try not to be afraid. I shall try to spread some of my warmth, of my genuine love for others wherever I go. But we shouldn't boast of our love for others. We cannot be sure that it really exists. I don't want to be anything special. I only want to try to be true to that in me which seeks to fulfill its promise. I sometimes imagine that I long for the seclusion of a nunnery, but I know that I must seek you amongst people out in the world.
Where did that come from? What a surrender. Take me by your hand. I shall evade none of the tempest life has in store for me. What does she know? She knows that they're rounding up Jews and that they're probably being killed. And she asks quite honestly, she's honest, I delight in warmth and security, but I should not rebel if I have to suffer cold, should you so decree. Someone was just saying, back on listening, just accepting what's there. When we feel our feelings, this is a thing she's going to go on with. Autobiographical statement. Saturday afternoon, I had the privilege of the 3:45 lecture in this room. And I sat here all by myself, having worked 2 or 3 hours to get ready for it. And I didn't feel too good. And but it didn't take my day because I took the time to feel through it. That's all I can say. I tried to say, well, where am I at? You know, I went through like, gee, did people come to my first lecture and not want to come back to my next one? Is everybody busy doing something else? Those were thoughts. But finally, I came down to the feeling that, gee, it's kind of lonely and I'm disappointed. And, gee, I went to this work and, you know, fortunately, I was preparing this at the same time. And I kind of said, well, okay, that feels cold. That's not warm. That's how I feel. It hurts. Yeah. But I didn't get into the judgment. I'm not a good lecturer. Holden should have more people in it now. Why did I get this? Why did I get this particular hour? Those are all the thinking parts, I think. To me, the emotional life is feeling one's feelings and accepting them. And then this too shall pass. I think it's when we stuff them, react to them, try to explain them, try to change them, then they overpower us. And I think that's what she's after here in terms of her prayer of surrender. Not that she wants to be cold, but if those cold moments come, then by your grace, I hope I can accept them. next paragraph here on 65 at the top. That is what I shall do despite the weariness and dislike that sometimes overcomes me. I vow to live my life out there to the full. Sometimes I think my life is only just beginning, but the real difficulties are still to come. Although at times I feel I've struggled through so many already, I shall study and try to comprehend. I shall allow myself to become thoroughly perplexed by whatever comes my way and apparently diverts me. Yes, I shall allow myself to be perplexed time and again, perhaps in order to arrive at a greater certainty. Until I am no longer perplexed and a state of balance has been achieved, with all paths still open to me, I don't know if I'm able to be a good friend to others, and if I cannot be because it's not in my nature, then I must face that as well. In any case, I must not try to fool myself, and I must keep within my own limitations and remember that I alone can set these. Wow. To me, I've got humble written in the margin here. Humble. Hey, maybe I won't even be a good friend, but I'll have to accept that. And okay to be perplexed. And again, and again, and again. I think in our culture, we want it easy. We want it now. We want a solution. Perplexity, oh, something's wrong if things are perplexing. And yet she is saying, hey, again and again, let me be perplexed. And then maybe because of that, I'll arrive at greater certainty. Very interesting side comment here. Next paragraph. It is if my relationship with S had suddenly changed. That's Spire. When her inside life really turns, her relationship to her outside life really turns. If you read the pages before her, she doesn't know what to do with this guy. And all of a sudden, it's purely unconscious, I think, on her part. She talks about her confession, and then she writes, as if my relationship to this guy is changed as well. And there's a huge clue here to me. If we can get our insides at peace, then we'll get clarity for that which goes on around us. Why an inner life? So that the outer life becomes congruous as well. So after this moment of conversion, continues to grow, if you will, and she describes herself in an interesting way on page 76. Do you have that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Last night, shortly before going to bed, I suddenly went down on my knees in the middle of this large room between the steel chairs and the matting, almost automatically, forced to the ground by something stronger than myself. Some time ago, I said to myself, I am a kneeler in training. I was still embarrassed by this act, as intimate as gestures of love that cannot be put into words either, except by a poet. She's embarrassed by kneeling. Why? How many of you are willing to admit you kneel when you pray, if at all? Not even going to ask. Do people kneel when they pray? Do you?
I do. It's pretty weird.
It's weird?
Well, I mean, it's just, it strikes me as strange that nobody else.
Anybody kneel when they pray?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Okay. And yet, gee, you know, I mean, is it weird to kneel or pretty weird that maybe you're one of three or four people in here that do?
Well, it's not odd to kneel in church when there's accommodation for that. That feels natural. But I guess what seems strange to me is it's a childhood thing. You kneel beside your bed and pray, and it feels a little bit like something maybe it just didn't outgrow. It's such a child's position.
Sometimes they lie flat on the ground.
And yet I hear this Jesus of Nazareth sending about the kingdom. How did it go? Unless we receive it as a child. I've done it infrequently. I've been driven to my knees in prayer. Anybody occasionally get to that position where you go to the bed face down or onto your knees and you're just like, and like that Pauline thing and groans too uncertain for words, driven to your knees. Is that almost like a reflexive, responsive thing? It's not like, I think I'll get to my knees right now. It doesn't happen that way, does it? Is it kind of like what she says here? Something went down on my knees in the middle of this large room between steel chairs, almost automatically forced to the ground by something stronger than myself. Both the nature of calamity. I remember particularly going for the coming home from my first interview for a call after seminary to my parents' home in the middle of winter, and being driven to my knees, saying, "Oh Lord, this is serious." I really felt a sense of like, am I really gonna like go ahead with this? Gulp. I just felt that sense of needing to get down. The AA program is very big on telling people to get to their knees. I mean, that's very explicit. It's not just a joke, get to your knees, but actually get to your knees. Well, of course, what does that mean? It means humility, right? And surrender. And childlikeness, to put the positive spin on it. She calls herself a kneeler in training, which I would like to call myself that. I was still embarrassed by this act. Then jumping down, she talks about the prayers she asked her friend S about his prayer. The courage to speak God's name, S once said to me, that took quite a long time before he dared to say God without feeling there was something ridiculous about it, even though he was a believer. And he said he prayed every night, prayed for others, and shameless and brazen as always, wanted to know everything there is to know. I asked, what exactly do you say when you pray? And he was suddenly overcome with embarrassment. This man who always had clear, glass-bright answers to all my most searching, intimate questions, and he said shyly, that I cannot tell you, not yet. How often do we talk to each other about what we pray about?
About what I pray about, but I can't say that I very often say what my prayers are.
That's very intimate. Yeah. So she's beginning, you know, this prayer thing is not like, you know, a 400 level course in a curriculum that we just kind of work up to. Oh, we're ready for prayer now. Give me the book. Right? I says, kneel here. Yeah, I got that. No. Write a little journal of your prayers last night. No. Dude, I mean, whoa. I mean, we just don't. And yet, we're supposed to do that. A little foretaste of the feast to come here in the middle of 77. 2 p.m. While cataloging Ness's books, I unexpectedly came across Rilke's Book of Hours. Paradoxically, though it may sound, S heals people by teaching them how to suffer and accept. There's the clue to the rest of the book right here about healing, acceptance and suffering. Very key little note just in passing here that she notes there. And I guess I'd like to move on that thought a little bit farther. 78, do you have? And 9? Yes or no? On the back of the last page, or doubled, or? Okay. Bottom of the page. 5 p.m. I know the intimate gestures he uses with women, but I still want to know the gestures he uses with God. More of that. And next page, the girl who could not kneel. This morning in the gray dawn, in a fit of nervous agitation, I suddenly found myself on the floor behind stripped bed and whatever, and his typewriter huddled up, my head on the ground, as if we were trying to seize peace by force. And when Han came in, and seemed a bit taken aback by this spectacle, I told him I was looking for a button. But that was a lie. And Tide, her friend, that strong 35-year-old redhead, said quite frankly one evening, speaking in her clear, bright voice, "You see, I'm like a child about this. When I'm in trouble, I kneel down in the middle of my room and ask God what to do. Her kisses are like a shy little girl's," Answorth showed me, "but her gestures to God are mature and certain." Mature and certain is, you see, I'm like a child about this. When I'm in trouble, I kneel down in the middle of my room and ask God what to do. She gets discovered in prayer. What does she say? I lost a button. You know, so she's still not quite sure here. But she can see. She can see someone else who's got it, if you will, you know, maturing this faith. I can't pass this page, moving back to 78, the great craning of mankind. See that paragraph here? The vast intellect and great heart of humankind, all ideas, however opposed, spring from a single brain, the brain of mankind and all mankind. I feel it's indivisible, and perhaps that explains why I'm sometimes filled with a deep sense of harmony and peace despite the many clashes. One has to know all the thoughts and let all emotions pass through one to judge what has been devised in that immense cranium and what has passed through that great heart. I was struck when I read that by something Goethe wrote. All truly wise thoughts have been thought already thousands of times. But to make them truly ours, we must think them over honestly until they take root in our personal experience. It's not enough just to read the great thoughts, but we have to mull them over to make them our own. And I really, when I read that and had just read this the day before, I thought, this is exactly what she's talking about here. It's not enough to like read it and have it read. The point of great thoughts and what has gone before is to make them our own. Let's see here. Here's another reason to turn inward, if you will, according to Eddie. It's on page 87 if you have a book. I don't think I copied this. She's having a conversation with a friend, Jan. What is it in human beings that make them want to destroy others? Jan asked bitterly. I said, human beings, you say, but remember, you're one yourself. And strangely enough, he seemed to acquiesce, grumpy, gruff old Jan. The rottenness of others is in us too. I continued to preach at him. I see no other solution. I really see no other solution than to turn inwards and to root out all the rottenness there. I no longer believe that we can change anything in the world until we have first changed ourselves. And that seems to me the only lesson to be learned from this war, that we must look into ourselves and nowhere else. What do you think of that? How do other human beings destroy others? Jan asks. He says, human beings, you say you're one too. And she says, the rottenness of others is in us too. I see no other solution, no other solution to turn inwards and root all the rottenness there. What's her solution to the Nazis? To go into herself. Do you buy that?
I do, but uncomfortably so.
Why?
Because there's a part that says, but that seems so simple compared to this huge thing. You've got to be out there doing something, you know. And that seems passive. It's not, but it seems passive, you know, against a... So, yeah, I follow that through and I say, yeah, that's right. And the other thing is, but I can't be right, you know. I'm uncomfortable with that, even though I really...
It's probably a both and here, but it's one quickly we, how could they do such a rotten thing, those terrible, and I guess I'm getting echoes of the smugness from Shelley's class here. How could they?
Not the class, what we talked about.
Yeah, what we talked about.
Period, right. The class was not smug.
Oh. Roll back the tape, I will.
Right, yeah.
Shelley wants to make a clarification here, right?
But the period that we get from looking at Nazi Germany and why did the church go farther? How come they didn't go sooner? Why did they do this? You can get real smug.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Why didn't they do that?
Right. And often when I'm reading about the period, I get smug.
Yeah. Why couldn't they? And how could they do such an awful thing?
Right.
And yet, you know, I would say this is really, before she goes taking the logs out of other people's eye, she's going to, you know, look at herself, yeah.
I was at a lecture a couple years ago with Yehuda Bauer, who teaches Holocaust studies at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, I think it was. And he was born in Poland in the late 30s and escaped to Israel with his family. And was talking about how some people want to see the Nazis as beasts or animals or devils and the Jews as saints. But he rejects that, saying, no, they're all human beings. And the same evil that was in the Nazis is also in everyone else. So he's presenting that idea.
Yeah.
Thinking two things. One, whose line is it? Is it Wiesel's line that there is a Holocaust in every person? The potential of the murder of another. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. But your comment earlier, sort of off the cuff, about Lutherans not having an inner life, you know, I'm probably, most of us here aren't Lutherans, but I'm struck by that sort of, as if denominationally there are those with inner lives and those without. Seems to me that there would be some people who would, in the face of this, say, I must go inward to know how to be connected to both the sin and the grace that's in me and the sin and the grace that's out of me. But there would be other people, and I don't think because of their denomination, but because of their makeup, who would have to make that same discovery by going out of themselves. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh.
People know that truth in different ways. And mm-hmm. Some probably do need to huddle alone in a small ball and go inward to know that. But that others will find themselves in going out. That their inner life is discovered by reaching out. Does that make sense?
It'll be discovered in that process, but I think the issue is the same. That one is going to have to, let me read on and see what, hold that thought, it's a very good one. I'm not proposing that everybody must have an inner life.
Well, I'm saying there may be more than one route to an inner life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. One more means, if you will. Rather than pure meditation, one may attend to one's inner life in a more communal, outward, active kind of thing.
Discovers the heart of oneself in the community rather than in solitude. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or some even combination of the two, maybe.
Sure. On this thought of one's own house cleaning. Page 99 if you got a book. All disasters stem from us. Why is there a war? Perhaps because now and then I might be inclined to snap at my neighbor. Because I am my neighbor and everyone else do not have enough love. Yet we could fight war in all its excrescences by releasing each day the love which is shackled inside us and giving it a chance to live. And I believe that I will never be able to hate any human being for his so-called wickedness, that I shall only hate the evil that is within me, though hate is perhaps putting it too strongly even then. In any case, we cannot be lax enough in what we demand of others, and strict enough in what we demand of ourselves. Lax enough in what we demand of others, and strict enough in what we demand of ourselves. Okay. Who do we have the power to change, ultimately? I mean, I could put a gun to your head and say, do this. Do you have to do it? The only person ultimately I can change is me. And I think that's one of the key issues of our time, really. Key issues of our time is that we want to blame conditions for where we're at, and if we change conditions for people and things, then people will get well. I am of the bent that I must change myself to meet conditions. That if anything's going to happen, it's going to have to start with me. That I can't change you, and that We can change conditions for people, and that doesn't necessarily change them at all. We have to have the ability in ourselves to attend to what we can do. I'm going to read one more thing here, which is a foretaste. Unless there's questions? Yep.
Well, isn't part of what you part of what I discover about myself when I go about changing myself is that part of the wretchedness is that I don't have the power to do that alone either. So, you know, if I start on this self-changing program, then like the people in the 12-step, I end up on my knees because I don't have the capacity to change myself. I mean, if I thought I had to wait till I changed myself to do anything, I don't know.
I keep thinking this has to have a lot to do with the fact that she found herself in a situation in which she really had no control over what was going on in the outside world. Mm-hmm. And when you have no control over what's going on the outside, you have to have control over something. You really have to have some control over something. You have control over yourself, or you can try to. And so it was a little bit like this business, the difference between being and doing. You may not have a lot of enough control over the exterior to be able to have much control over doing, but you can have control over, perhaps, being. And it's a way of giving yourself permission not to be affecting the outside world.
Thanks for the segue here. I'm going to conclude here with 106, 107. She says to be very unobtrusive and very insignificant, always striving for more simplicity. Yes, to become simple and live simply, not only within yourself, but also in your everyday dealings. Don't make ripples all around you. Don't try so hard to be interesting. Keep your distance. Be honest. Fight the desire to be thought fascinating by the outside world. Everybody should read this on the way into Holden, huh? At least I did. Instead, reach for true simplicity in your inner life, in your surroundings, and also work. Yes, work. It doesn't matter at what. I still haven't found solid ground under my feet, but whether it's Russian essays or reading Dostoevsky and Jung or having a talk, all these can be work. And have confidence that it will all come together and everything will turn all right in the end. That's confidence, something I've had in a long time. Then jumping a paragraph. All that matters now is the deep inner serenity for the sake of creation. Whether I shall ever create is something I can't really tell. But I do believe that it's possible to create, even without ever writing a word or painting a picture, by simply molding one's inner life. And that, too, is a deed. That when you have very little control about everything, that one can order oneself, not in the sense of like denial of the world, but at least keep oneself as centered as possible. She will eventually, getting back to this, moving on where we're going to go from here, she spends about a year in July of 1942, the same time Anne Frank goes into hiding and starts her diaries within blocks of where Eddie lives. She gets a position with a Jewish consul in Amsterdam. And that the Germans set up the Jewish consul to do their paperwork, basically, and gave them the feeling that the people that did have papers and status, and it was all a sham. But through that, she did get some mobility, if you will. Westerbork Camp was the camp to which all the Dutch Jews were sent. It was a holding camp. And weekly, 1,000 Jews were put on the train for Poland. And she spent a whole year plus at Westerbork working in the hospital at Westerbork. But because of her Jewish consul connection, she got in and out several times back to Amsterdam. And in fact, after a month in Westerbork, she became ill and spent a month in Amsterdam, which is the last month of her diaries. There are some letters in the back of this book, and then there's a whole book of her letters. But in September of 43, she shipped off to Auschwitz and then killed November 30th, 43. Not until 1981 are these diaries published.